This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Most of you live in cities. The majority of humans do. Is your city ready for climate disruption? You know it is not. And just planting more trees won't cut it for what is coming. For the past couple of decades, Dr. Brian Stone studied cities in a changing climate, from nighttime heat stress through grid failure during heat waves. His 2012 book, The City and the Coming Climate, Climate Change in the Places We Live, won awards. Professor Stone is director of the Urban Climate Lab at Georgia Tech. Now, at this late date in the climate shift, he goes further. Stone's latest book is Radical Adaptation, Transforming Cities for a Climate-Changed World. From Atlanta, Brian Stone, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex. Thrilled to be with you again.
Am I right? Are we past the point where a few zoning and bylaw changes will be enough to keep cities going into the future?
Yeah, you are correct, and that really was the driving impetus of the book. I would say, you know, the era of conventional climate adaptation has ended. And by that I mean, you know, using our standard approaches to environmental management and hazard mitigation in cities really won't be sufficient to address the level of stress we're seeing, whether it be rising seas and flooding, droughts, wildfire and extreme heat. Our standard approaches to dealing with these kinds of hazards are not going to be sufficient.
You studied the vulnerabilities of cities to increasing extreme heat, and last time we talked, you warned there are not nearly enough cooling centers in America, at least, with generator backup for a grid failure. Can you report more progress, or are most of us still exposed to a potential crisis with every hotter summer?
It's a critical question, and we followed up that study we discussed last time, Alex, with an additional study which was trying to actually measure how many people would be at risk of severe heat illness or death in American cities, and we looked specifically at Phoenix and Atlanta and Detroit. And we found if you had a concurrent blackout during a heat wave of historical intensity, so not a future heat wave, but an actual heat wave we've experienced in the past, that in a city like Phoenix, you would see as many as 1% of the population succumb to heat stroke, to die, and more than half the population would need to go to the hospital. And so, you know, these are conditions for which we are just not prepared. We're seeing levels of heat and humidity that we've never seen before, and our emergency response protocols, just including just the basic number of emergency department beds, is not sufficient. So I think we are in a new landscape where we will require a different set of strategies to respond to these kinds of challenges.
Back in 2019, you suggested, quote, the UK is quietly becoming one of the deadliest places on Earth for heat waves. How can that happen in a green and pleasant land, and why heat waves as hurricanes?
Well, yeah, that was a paper that I was focused on, how heat and the threat of extreme heat is actually quite different than hurricanes. And this is a good example because we have a whole system of responding to established threats like hurricanes that don't translate as well for new kinds of threats in the form of heat and humidity that we've never seen before. And so heat is not, you know, it's not the kind of threat that leads to a lot of property damage. Often we don't have time to evacuate a city. We don't have such an acute warning system for heat. And so we need a very different set of protocols for dealing with heat. And the most important is to just cool down cities in the advance of extreme heat events. Having cooling centers is critical. We need cooling centers with backup power generation. But we need to have cities that are just cooler to begin with. And that requires really substantial changes to the way we build the city and design it. And so those are the kinds of strategies that I'm focused on in the book.
And looking at cities in the American East or the United Kingdom and all over Europe, there are more and more extreme rainfall events with flash flooding. We couldn't list all the cities coping with wild flash floods this past year. Social media was peppered with videos of floating cars and homes underwater. Brian, how much of that is due to overdevelopment and maldevelopment, and how much to climate change? Do we know?
I don't know that we know as far as the percentage contribution. It would vary from city to city. But it is important to note that the way we have designed our cities has resulted in, you know, what can be characterized in some instances as a machine for flooding. I mean, we really have engineered our cities to divert water rather than capturing it. And we divert it to waterways and storm sewer systems that are insufficient for the volumes we're seeding. And that really just contributes to flooding. And so, you know, all of the surface ceiling we have in cities through all the auto-oriented development, the parking lots and the streets, is really quite a problem. And so, you know, our traditional modes, what I would say is a mode of conventional climate adaptation, is to build larger and larger storm sewers, larger diameter pipes, centralized wastewater treatment facilities. These kind of traditional approaches really don't address the root problem here, is that we have too much stormwater that's being generated by the city itself. And so in an earlier era of human settlement design, buildings were designed to capture and store water. It was a critical resource that we thought should be stored and used on site, whether it's irrigation, drinking water. We still have the capacity to build that way and to retrofit our cities, but that would move us away from these large centralized facilities for dealing with environmental hazards to more dispersed, kind of every building, every parcel designed to be responsive to climate change and to its local environment. So that's a key premise or a key idea in the book, is that we need to move towards strategies that are not spatially centralized but are distributed throughout the entire city.
Yeah, one of the ideas in your book is that we now have to get used to adaptation all the time, everywhere, instead of just waiting for a big change and we'll plan it and maybe 5 years from now we'll do something.
You know, again, in an earlier period of city making, we were much more responsive to our local environments. And so we designed buildings to be responsive to climate conditions, whether it was solar orientation or elevating them to channel the wind in a certain way or shading patterns. We have, with the availability of mechanical air conditioning, large public works systems to deal with stormwater or deal with drinking water, we have designed more contemporary cities to be non-responsive to their local environments. And I think we're discovering that these large engineered systems just will not be sufficient to deal with the type of climate stresses we're seeing. And many of the stresses are amplified by the city itself. And so as we are responding over time, we need to be redeveloping our cities to be less a contributor to these stresses than they are now in their current form.
The U.S. Census Bureau says approximately 40% of the U.S. population lives within 100 miles of the east or west coasts. In fact, the United Nations says about 40% of the whole world's population lives within 100 kilometers of the coast. That's 62 miles. Humans thrive near oceans. Major cities with millions and millions of people live where rising seas and storm surge can rush in. We're already seeing it. Can we count on building defenses? Is that what is happening, or will it be that we have to retreat from the sea?
Well, we will need to retreat. We are retreating. I describe two modes of retreat in the book, retreat by disaster or retreat by design. And, of course, we should be retreating by design. We've created somewhat of a binary that you're describing. It's like, do we build adaptive infrastructure or do we retreat? I think that frames the problem incorrectly. I think retreat is the initial step in adaptation. We usually think of retreat as the last step, whether once all other strategies have failed. I really think we should reframe that as the first step, because what we critically need, whether it's adapting to sea level rise or adapting to flooding in cities that aren't coastal or even adapting to heat, is we need more urban land for the installation of adaptive infrastructure, whether it's, you know, traditional engineered gray infrastructure or green infrastructure. And so what we seem to be missing is this idea that planned retreat is a process of abandonment as opposed to a process of assembling land for critical infrastructure. And so we do see some successful projects around the world where programs of property acquisitions and buyouts are used to assemble land to then build, whether it's a sea wall or a more extensive series of natural coastal wetlands, that is much more successful in managing the threat than, you know, a piecemeal buyout process or just constantly rebuilding. And it's this constant rebuilding that is really the mode of adaptation right now in the United States.
Well, maybe we live inland, high up in Denver or far upstream on the Danube River. Are those city dwellers going to be okay? Do they just need to prepare for refugees from the coast and the overheated drought zones, or does everybody have to do this?
Yeah, everybody has to do this, and this is a key argument in the book, is that there are at least three climate-related threats that every city is confronting, and that is extreme flooding, extreme drought, and extreme heat. We will not avoid this by simply retreating from the coast. And if you find yourself in the in the middle sections of a large landmass, you also will not avoid this. And so, if we look at we've recently seen in the United States, we had our fifth national climate assessment just released a few weeks ago, and it was reporting on billion-dollar disasters and how we've gone from about four of these a year in constant dollars to we had about 18 of these in 2022. And I'm sure it's true. I know it's true in other parts of the world too. And so part of the challenge with this is that we are not recognizing that the major type of disaster in the United States is from extreme rain events. It's not hurricanes at the coast. It's extreme rain events getting more rainfall in a more narrow window of time than we've ever seen before. When that happens in an urban environment where we have sealed the environment again with extensive impervious cover, we have accelerated and amplified flooding. And so most of the major events we're seeing today aren't even on in coastal areas. And so really all cities need to be aware of these three threats: flooding, extreme heat, and drought.
It seems like whenever we see the news about the fires or the floods, it's the trailer parks that flood first. It's the lower-income people in Paradise, California, who get burned out. Talk to us about the principle of least first. Is that just due to a sense of justice, or is it really necessary?
Well, it's really necessary. So the idea, I have these four principles that I believe are a component part of radical adaptation. And the first one is that radical adaptation needs to be dispersive. We need to be focused on not just these centralized responses, but responding everywhere all the time, as you mentioned. And the second is that is this principle of least first, is that these communities that are most vulnerable to climate stresses need to be the first communities that we're working with, whether it's investing in the quality of the housing to make it more resilient, or to assist people in moving out of hazard zones, or to install adaptive infrastructure. And this, it sounds like a simple point that these most vulnerable communities should be our priority. What we see in the early responses to climate adaptation is actually quite the opposite. It tends to be the more affluent communities that are getting the governmental assistance. And that is really an inversion of the way we should think about this. The other variable to consider is that most of these, historically marginalized communities, particularly in the United States, are in these high hazard zones. And so these are the lowlands that flood the most commonly, or the most denuded areas that lack natural tree canopy and other vegetation and become the hottest zones in the city. These are the places we need to be investing in first. And so that this second principle of the least first, critical, I think, to, yes, addressing climate justice, but also most effectively targeting the areas that are going to be most stressed by climate shocks.
And then most North American cities and suburbs were built around the car. We have houses in cul-de-sacs with nothing in walking distance, no public transportation. An article in Newsweek, January 15th, 2024, says Americans can no longer afford their cars. New cars cost what a house did. Used cars prices are insane. Insurance is high up there. More and more working people can't afford a car, and they can't make a living without one. Are people going to walk away from all those homes during a housing shortage? That doesn't seem likely. What can be done?
This is really an idea at the core of the book, that if we're simply focused on adaptation as a response to climate change, it will probably fail politically and physically as a set of strategies. We really need to understand climate adaptation as a response to numerous kind of critical crises in the city today. And one of those crises is affordability, as you mentioned. We have an affordable housing crisis in cities. And so in responding to climate change, we can address both of these agendas. We have a tremendous amount of underutilized space in cities, impervious surface parking lots, on-street parking. My neighborhood, or my part of the world, Atlanta, we have really extensive suburban shopping malls that have been largely abandoned. These spaces can be redeveloped to be more conducive to affordability, but at the same time, less contributing to stormwater flows, extensive heat, and the amplifying factors of the city. And so we really need to combine these two strategies. There's been some very innovative projects. Typically in the Netherlands has always been a leader in this context, but with amphibious housing, the notion that some of these urban waterways that have been industrial docklands are actually quite suitable for housing that either is physically floating on the surface of the water or capable of rising up when floodwaters come in. That is an opportunity for using underutilized space for small-scale, more affordable housing, housing that's very well-situated for renewable power generation and other modes of transportation within dense cities. This is a combining of these two strategies focused on both adaptation and affordability that I think will make these types of strategies more appealing to communities as we move forward.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Professor Brian Stone from the Urban Climate Lab at Georgia Tech. We are talking about radical adaptation for cities in a time of climate extremes. In recent months, winter is hotter than normal throughout much of the northern hemisphere with crazy records all over. It's very strange here. No snow in Canada in January. People in South America, though, they're frying in the heat with high humidity and hardly any relief at night. Big cities there, as in Africa, are surrounded by slums and uncontrolled growth. Is hope for radical urban transformation just for the developed world where we can afford it?
No, I don't think at all. I don't think so at all. And I think, you know, some of these communities, these informal settlements, have some of the most compelling adaptive features that the global north can learn from. I mean, this notion of amphibious housing is actually a very traditional practice that we see in many parts of the world. Vietnam is one example of floating houseboats, but also this amphibious housing that can rise up when floodwaters come in. That's been a long-term practice in various parts of the world that more industrialized cities can learn from. And again, I think these are the very places that we need to be intervening first. And so most of the principles and strategies that I explore in the book are pretty low-tech strategies. They rely, again, on collection of rainwater on site. They're more reliance on the energy we're given from the sun to power our buildings and to warm them in the winter. The use of collective resources to manage these stresses and promote greater community amenities. Another potential benefit of planned retreat is to, once we acquire land for adaptive infrastructure, to also make these formerly occupied spaces available for public use. This is another example where the Dutch have been quite innovative in acquiring land to allow for more natural flooding of their riverways, but then to also repurpose that land in periods where it's not flooding for community amenities like parks and amphitheaters and extensive biking networks. As we move toward greater retreat, which I think will be unavoidable everywhere in the world, we need to be also thinking about these amenities that communities need and these opportunities for affordable housing.
I wonder if cities can change. Back in 2009, I broadcast from a Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver. The EcoCity World Summit was in Montreal in 2010. And then we have transition towns. That movement seems quieter, though it is continuing. Most cities seem frozen in the past. Brian, what will it take to finally bring on radical adaptation?
Well, cities are always changing. They're changing in small ways. They are forever being redeveloped piece by piece. And so I think part of the problem of thinking about large-scale engineered strategies for adaptation is that it loses sight of this kind of organic, ongoing change process that's always happening in cities. For city governments, the way we interact with this process of change is through zoning codes and ordinances that essentially regulate how we can build, but then how we can change our structures over time. And so by changing these basic ordinances within cities that constrain our building process, we can change the fundamental DNA that drives urban design. And there's some great examples of this from around the world. What's known as the Seattle Green Factor in Seattle, Washington, sets a minimum amount of green cover that every parcel based on zoning class must achieve. And so anytime you build anew, you must meet that standard. You can meet it in different ways. You can have more tree cover. You can have a green roof. You can have a vertical garden. Different ways of achieving the standard, but whether you're building anew or renovating or putting a new roof on your structure, anytime you have to secure a permit to modify that property, you have to bring it up to code. And our code should have minimum green cover standards, but also standards that are regulating how much stormwater you generate, how much heat the building is producing. All of these impacts can be addressed through our building codes, but we rarely leverage that as an adaptive strategy.
Well, in many countries, cities are actually taking the lead in adaptation, and according to your book, that's really the way it should be. The more localized you get, the better it's going to work.
I think that's true, and it's true because of this constant process of urban change that I'm describing. These cities are not going to change overnight, but they are always changing. And so by leveraging that, we can reduce some of the contribution of the city itself to increased temperatures and flooding and drought. Of course, having a strong national government involved is also critical. And so we find ourselves in the United States where we are slowly starting to pass some federal legislation. But I'd say most of these efforts to date, while very, you know, positive on the side of reducing emissions, are not fundamentally positioning us very well to adapt to the changes that are already here and that are in the pipeline for us.
Can you give us more examples of steps that actually are being taken, either in America or Europe or anywhere, that give us clues about what this radical adaptation is heading for?
Yeah, I'll give you an example from your own country of Canada. One of the reasons I titled the book Radical Adaptation is it's drawn from the idea of radical planning theory. And radical planning is a set of ideas about how, in some instances, it's the governing institutions and protocols themselves that impede positive societal responses to challenges. These were ideas that were born of the civil unrest in the United States in the 1960s, but we have more contemporary examples, Black Lives Matter, the Occupy Wall Street movement in the United States. These were moves that fundamentally were suggesting that it was the governing institutions that were most at fault for whatever the mode of societal distress was. In the context of radical adaptation for my book, I'm not suggesting that we need to have extreme responses per se or that we need to work outside of government, but we do need to recognize when governing institutions themselves are a significant impediment to adapting to climate stress. A very clear example in the United States is the Federal Emergency Management Agency and our approach to dealing with sea level rise and repetitive flooding events. We have national policies that provide funding for a constant pattern of rebuilding in very high hazard zones that we know will flood again, that we know will be subject to hurricanes again. And whether or not you're carrying flood insurance, the federal government is there to assist you in rebuilding time and time again. So that is not a positive way to move into climate adaptation. A recent exception we see to this approach, that is the approach of many national governments. In Quebec, in the aftermath of flooding events in 2017 and 2019 in the city of Gatineau, there on the Ottawa River, a policy change was made to enable either property buyouts for parcels that had flooded. Many of these flooded in both of these events, both in 2017 and 2019. So they really, many of them were not even fully restored and had flooded again. And so the provincial government said, we will either buy out your property or assist you in rebuilding, but only one time. And so you have the ability to rebuild your property in a hazard zone one time, and in the future there'll be no more, you know, national assistance. And that really changes the calculus for a property owner, whether they want to accept a buyout. Because if they know that there will be no more governmental support moving forward, that will devalue their property. That's recorded publicly as part of the deed. And so any future property owner would not be eligible for federal disaster assistance. That, I think, is a very smart policy. It doesn't force people to sell, but it changes the range of incentives, and so I'd like to see that more widely adopted.
When threatened by new situations, and this is a new situation, humans often retreat toward their vision of the past. Even folks who lost their homes during storms or fires try to rebuild the same fragile system. There's a growing consensus the real threat is less climate change and more inability to achieve human change. Are you optimistic your research and books could be put to use in time?
I am optimistic. I think there, you know, for those of us who have been doing this for a long time, Alex, and you're certainly one of those individuals, and I am too, we haven't seen the level of responsiveness in the general public, at least in North America, that we do now. It's really undeniable, not only that climate change is happening, but it's having impacts on our lives right now. And, you know, with every passing summer, we're getting closer to levels of heat and humidity in cities where it just will not be safe to go outside for anyone of any level of fitness. And so, you know, that's very constraining on, you know, our quality of life, and also has, you know, some pretty significant economic implications, particularly if you're a younger person. So I do think there's an appetite for a more kind of muscular approach to thinking about climate adaptation within the government, but also within community institutions. So I think there's an appetite there. But like I said before, we should not think of this simply as a climate adaptation initiative, but as a set of strategies that can achieve many objectives that we have in cities. One of those is affordable housing. We mentioned that. Greater engagement with our communities and neighbors is something that I think many of us are hungry for. And then we have a lot of long-standing ecological challenges and problems. We're seeing a lot of studies coming out now suggesting that our drinking water simply isn't safe with these forever chemicals. A general suite of strategies simply to make our cities more ecologically responsive, to look more like the ecosystems that they exist within, can go a long way to addressing many of these long-standing challenges while also reducing the impacts of climate change.
Your new book is Radical Adaptation, Transforming Cities for a Climate-Changed World. Who is your target audience, and who can work with the tools and options you offer?
Well, it's planners, government officials, but I've really tried to design the book to speak to any reader that's interested in climate change, and particularly interested in how climate change is playing out in cities. As we've mentioned, cities themselves are amplifying really all of the effects of climate change. And the most direct route for us to be impacted within cities is probably not a hurricane, but some kind of a failure of critical urban infrastructure. We have our electrical grid systems that are failing with rising frequency. In the United States, over a recent five-year period, we've seen the number of major blackout events more than double over a very short period of time. And so, you know, these kinds of critical infrastructure failures are happening at the moment that the infrastructure is most critical to us. So in the midst of a heat wave, we have such demand on the electrical grid that we are losing our access to mechanical cooling when we most need it. That is something that it's very likely that most everybody in your audience will experience, has recently experienced, or will experience. And as we're approaching really critical levels of heat and humidity for just the human body, these kinds of mechanical systems are life support systems for us. Our affluence won't help us deal with this if we find ourselves in a situation where critical infrastructure is failing. You know, in our basic storm sewer systems is the same type of issue. We're seeing major flooding events in cities, lots of property damage, and some loss of life, because the city itself is contributing to flash floods of events due to the fact that we have an engineered storm sewer system that is no longer able to cope with the volumes of water.
From the School of City and Regional Planning at Georgia Institute of Technology, we have been speaking with Dr. Brian Stone. His new book tells us where we are, Radical Adaptation, Transforming Cities for a Climate-Changed World. To find out more, you can use links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Brian Stone, thank you so much for talking with us again.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks so much.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.